Welcome to Digital Praxis 4, Queer Archival Presences Online. I was very pleased to be asked to chair this panel because I am fascinated with how we represent ourselves online and what that can tell us about how we understand history-making in the current climate. My name is Jennifer Evans. I'll be chairing, and I just thought I'd give you a few ideas about how we're going to work things this afternoon. We have a whole bunch of folks presenting, a couple of teams, which is cool. I love collaboration. But in the interests of space, they're going to sit in the front row. I'm going to introduce them individually before their papers, and then when there's time for Q&A, they'll take a space in these extremely comfy chairs, and you'll get a chance to ask them your questions. I have the pleasure of introducing the first speaker, Connie von Hiels, who works at the ELA, LGBT Heritage Archives in Amsterdam, where I've done research too, and if you haven't, it's a wonderful space to do research, just a plug. She's been working there for more than 10 years. One of her most recent tasks is the digitization, preservation, and registration of the collection of objects and ephemera. So I'd like to welcome Connie to the stage, please. She'll be presenting creating an online presentation of the history of gay and lesbian nightlife by using ephemera. Connie.
Hi, everybody. I'll try to open my PowerPoint first. Last week in Amsterdam, one of my colleagues said, well, you should try to start your presentation with a really great introduction. Maybe something about Berlin or something about the actualities or about the now. And I thought a lot, but I couldn't think of anything. So I'll just start my presentation. So my name is Connie van Hiels, and you see at the PowerPoint that the bisexual flag sort of got against my name. This is because of its different computers. I hope it won't go on like that with things sort of touching each other without me wanting it. So, ELA, Jennifer already said, is a wonderful institution. 40 years ago, it started as the Homo Doc. And 4 years later, there was a lesbian archive. This was the time of the gender wars, as everybody knows, so those were two separate institutions. And in 2000, after the wars, the peace came, they got together and formed the ELA archive, later the ELA LGBT Heritage Archives. We are located now in the Central Library of Amsterdam, which is a really great place to be, with a lot of status. And we started, of course, underground in little closets and cellars and things. So that's some progress. We have a worldwide collection. We're not collecting only about things about the Netherlands, but we try to do as much as possible also from countries where it's not so easy to collect things from or preserve them. So we are also a safe space for collections from countries where there is quite some repression, like Russia or Ukraine, something like that. India, maybe. My job, Jennifer said it, was to preserve things that aren't meant to be preserved, more or less. It's not totally true. But ephemera are just like one-day flies. They only mean to live one day. So they're meant to throw away. But they tell so much about history that we don't throw them away. We try to keep them. Apart from that, we also have lots of art, and we also have 8 quilts. But I started with the small things because the large things are more difficult to do. And then recently we get loads of rainbows. I'm not so happy with thousands of rainbows. You see here a sticker of the Labyrinth women's dancing in Amsterdam. One of the things I do. So after I've been working for quite a while, I thought, what to do with all this? And what is interesting? What is the story behind these photographs we now have of all those things that we first had in big banana boxes? And I thought a lot about making an attractive, interactive database, and I did some research. And of course, everybody wants to see photographs and pictures these days, but it's difficult with the copyright and the personal right and everything. And I thought, well, also the way LGBT people depict themselves with pencil and paper is very interesting over the years, and also the language used. So this is a postcard you see here of the second provincial lesbian party festival from 82. You can see the clothes is, you know, a time picture of the time, and the hair. I discovered that there was loads and loads of interest for places of pride. There are many initiatives around the whole world, personal and organizational, of people wanting to sort of keep the spaces they once owned or maybe still own. Space is important. It's not just etheric, that it moves, it stays there, buildings are still there. You could say, okay, this was my favorite bar, also after it's gone. So this is a Christmas card of the card of the Christmas twins, is famous gay owners of a coffee shop. They were in Amsterdam for many years. They were very well known, and it's also signed. It's difficult to see because it faded with time. So I was looking for similar projects. I thought, what am I going to do? How am I going to do it? How difficult is it? It's very difficult. I can tell you that it's very difficult to have an introduction of a database that shows you immediately, oh, wow, this is this. If you look at the attempts, you really have to dive into it to see the deeper picture, and I would like to sort of solve that, but I can't do that myself. I'll show you, this is a very nice attempt. It's the graveyard of lesbian bars, gay and lesbian bars of Amsterdam. I thought it was a sort of dead, but I noticed that they recently have started to go on with it. So this is the graveyard. I think that's a very nice picture of as an introduction. And then you get an alphabetical list, which gets longer and longer, of course, with bars. And the nice thing is they have all visited those bars. So the things they write about the bars is real experience. And that makes it very interesting to read, because you know immediately like what kind of bar, what kind of music, what kind of public there is. Now I have to go back to my PowerPoint. Sorry about this. I can't find my, where I stayed. This is the whole thing. Okay, thank you. That's it. Which one? Because I have to do it again. No, not the next. If I now choose another website. So this is New York. LGBT historic sites. I have to go back to my PVP in a minute. So they start like this. And then you get this map. And then view the full map. And go away. And then you see what they've done. They've done all sorts of squares in different colors. I think blue is bars. And then there are other things. So here you see the Starlight Lounge, bars, clubs, and restaurants. And then you go on. And you see it. It's in Brooklyn. And they have some information. So it's really neat, very cool to see. Needs a lot of clicking. And now you have to go back again to see the next bar. So it's a huge project. I think it's really well done. They don't have pictures of everything, but they have a lot of pictures. So that was a sort of example. But I finally chose to do a history pin, mainly because the UK was doing a history pin. Because that has like more ways of organizing the information you have. Here you see an advertisement from 79, from a travesty bar, because I don't have enough objects, ephemera, memorabilia, to do all the bars. I try to collect things through crowdsourcing and everything, but it's really difficult to get it all. This is old, of course, and it's also beautiful, so we scanned advertisement as well. So, History Pin connecting communities with local history is sometimes tricky because they know where you are. So you want to see Amsterdam, but you're in Berlin. They show you Berlin. This is the famous owl. I don't know if everybody knows about the owl. In Holland, some time ago, the police and civilian would enter bars to check if there are minors, to check if there was dancing between males and females, because that was all forbidden, and a minor was someone under 21 or 23, what was it, 21. And then they had these owls. These owls are perfume lamps, and when the police came in, because of course they knew who they were, there were not so many police guys in civilian in those days, so they would put it on, and it has a scent. You have to put perfume in it, and the eyes go on like this, and then they know, okay, there are owls in the house. Be straight. So it's a nice start, I think, of the bar culture. So that's a nice start. But then you see this. So you see the map of Holland, and you see like two pictures. It doesn't really give you an idea of the richness of this collection. We have pinned like 356 unique bars in Holland. I work together with Peter Koop. He's a researcher of the nightlife, the gay and lesbian nightlife. These are the two recent things you see here. I used a picture from the internet because I really wanted to put Bordeaux on the site, and I really couldn't find anything in more than a year. So I thought, okay, I steal the picture, and if they complain about copyright, I say, okay, give me something else then. This is recently added. There are loads of possibilities here. You can also select like the most popular. Then you can see that we started really with the ephemera memorabilia. That's a jigsaw sort of thing from the web, still open. April is not open anymore. This is the newest first, and the oldest first is more interesting. For the very old, I didn't have anything but a newspaper article about a raid in a gay bar, and they just went in with loads of police, took everybody out, and next day it was in the newspaper. So that's how we know it happened. Then there is at Manche. It's the oldest gay bar still open, although it was closed for 20 years. Here is a report. It's also not an ephemera, to be honest. From the police, where I was talking about, and they go there and they say, okay, the homosexuals we found here, they were just a little bit better class than the other ones from the other street we go to. But at the same time, they had the same features. How do I say that? But the bulk is... ephemera. This is an invitation from the Leather Club from Rotterdam, their third anniversary, and it was in the Cosmonaut. And that must have been somewhere around 1977. So, another thing you can do is, if you want to know the history of a street, you can just put in Amstel, that's the street, and there were quite some bars. All those bars are now here. Come down. And if you want, you can organize them like in a chronological way, alphabetical way, whatever you would like to know about that street. It's all there. I think we have the whole street. We have quite some streets complete, but we're not ready yet. So, it is a bit of a site that is not very easy accessible, and also sometimes it doesn't do what you want. You can also, you see here a timeline, you can actually choose which period you would like to see, and then choose, for example, Utrecht. And then you can see the bars Utrecht from 1911 to 1982. So it has quite some possibilities. I have 5 more minutes. We'll get there to do. So you can do a lot of research with it. You can research streets, times, places. There was a time that every village in Holland had a gay bar. And I did some... I'm trying to get back to my PowerPoint now. Can you help me once more? So I did a little research myself, and I thought, like, what was the ideal gay guy of the 80s? What features did he have? And I found one very interesting thing. It was the mustache. So I did a little research in my own database to find pictures of the ideal guy which bars would introduce themselves as, oh, come to us, we have this. So this is the mustache of the 80s, cowboy style. Also the names have are cowboy style. This is leather style. We have here the cruising style, and we have here a romantic style, mustaches, and last but not least, married couple style. I'm not an art historian, but I mean, if you know something about art and pictures, this is more illustrations. I'm very fond of illustrations. You can do something with that because it changes. You don't see them anymore. It's gone. So what's next? I would like to have like an introduction that is what has a wow factor, that you think, oh wow, we're going to see this, and that you don't bounce when you see, oh, that's a map of Holland and a pig. I didn't see anything else. You don't want that. So we need better interfaces, and everybody's doing their own thing, and they all have something really wonderful. But, well, I'm really desperate for some help to make this better and also to make this maybe worldwide. So, that's it. Final remarks. If you want to assess the platform, it's not so easy, you will see, but the best way is to go to the ILIA website and then go scroll down, and there you see the McDonald's bar, and then you click, and then you are in the on the right place. You don't come in Berlin or New York or whatever. Thank you for your attention.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. The next group, and it's a sort of a surprise because I was led to believe that only one of four would be here, but we have all four members of this group, and so I'm happy to introduce all four of them. One of them will speak, and then you'll have questions maybe for all of them. They all perform different tasks and roles on this project. Christine Olderdissen, Martina Minnet-Dreyer, Raimund Wolfert, and Sigrid Krujek. I'm going to introduce Raimund because he's going to speak with us today. He is a member and co-worker of the Magnus Hirschfeld Gesellschaft Society in Berlin since about 2005. And in recent years, he has been the librarian and archivist of the society, and he served as the editor of the magazine. Oops, and there's my alarm going off because Connie kept to time and then some. He was the editor of the magazine Mitteilungen der Magnus Hirschfeld Gesellschaft. Most of this work, it's important to say, is done voluntarily. And in his professional life, he is a teacher. So welcome, Raimund, to the stage.
Yeah, hello. Hi, everybody. And thank you for coming and for having me here. Christine is going to help me with finding the website that we are going to present today. There is a presentation for about 20 minutes that we have to improvise because I had the information that I should be the only one to be here last week too because everybody had to do very important work. Yeah. So I hope you can hear me. But happily, everything changed, and now my friends are here. Sigrid Krujek, sitting there. She's the actress, and she's singer. She's performing on our website. Martina Minnet-Dreyer, she's sitting in the first row. She did the painting, the drawing. She made the illustrations to the website. And here on my left-hand side is Christine Olderdissen, the web designer. Without her help, nothing could have been possible. So she really realized the website. The site deals with the life and the works of Eva Sievert, a woman who was born in Wrocław, today in Poland, in 1907, and she died here in Berlin in 1994, more or less totally unnoticed by the public and, or at least even by us in the gay and lesbian community of that time. When I started to do my research a couple of years ago, there was more or less nothing. There was almost nothing that was known about her life. I did some research in 2015 that ended in a small book about Kurt Hiller, a very famous person in the first German homosexual movement from the time before 1933. And Kurt Hiller, he had been a co-worker of Magnus Hirschfeld in the Scientific Humanitarian Committee and in the Institute for Sexual Science. And he was a very, very, very busy a writer of letters. And his estate is not scientifically worked out. So in West Germany, there's a private archive where the letters of 2,300 pen pals of Kurt Hiller still lie unread. And when I wrote this book about the 1950s and the re-establishment of a German homosexual movement, I came across the name of Eva Sievert for the first time in my life. As I said before, there was nothing known about her. She had been active in a organization that was started here in Berlin in 1949. And I became curious, especially after I had found a signed photograph of her on the internet. I could buy it at eBay. So I found out that Eva Sievert, she had been a famous radio speaker in Luxembourg in the 1930s. She spoke fluently in English and in French, and she got a job in Luxembourg as one of the first female voices on the radio. She spoke English, French, and German there. And she got that job after having lived in Tehran in Persia for some time. So at that time she learned different languages. And when she came back to Germany, she looked for work and she got this job in Luxembourg. Before that, she had been an opera singer, but she had to give up her career because of problems with her lungs. She suffered from attacks of asthma. In the early 1930s, she lived in Luxembourg, but in 1938, she decided to travel as far from Europe as possible because she was afraid of the war to come. And in her case, this meant that she should travel back to Tehran. She came here to Berlin in order to get valid travel documents, but when she came here, the Nazis refused to give them to her because she was a so-called half-Jew. Something that had no meaning to her in Luxembourg. But when she was here in Berlin, she was confronted with her half-Jewish identity. And she was in some way trapped, caught in Germany. She couldn't travel out again. And at that point of time, she must have come in touch with a woman who was called Elise Kallea. It was even less that was known about Elise Kallea than of Eva Sievert when I came across her name for the first time. Elise, she was Jewish, and she was deported to Auschwitz, and she was murdered in the concentration camp of Auschwitz in 1943. So when I started the research about Eva Sievert, I found out that this is not only the story of a former opera singer or of a prolific radio speaker or of a writer, but it was the story of a love affair in the German Third Reich that ended in Auschwitz. Probably you have heard about the project Stumbling Blocks by Gunter Demnig. Up to now, the Stumbling Blocks project is the world's largest project of memory, existing, or it consists of about 70,000 blocks that have been laid in 24 countries of the world, commemorating Jewish people, homosexual people, physically and mentally disabled people, and people from the German anti-Nazi resistance movement, communists and social democrats. And when I came across the name of Elise Kallea and Eva Sievert, we in the Magnus Hirschfeld Society, we decided to lay four stumbling blocks for Elise Kallea, who was murdered in Auschwitz together with her sister, Charlotte Kallea, and their parents who were murdered in Theresienstadt about a year before the daughters were caught and sent to the concentration camp. And these stumbling blocks, they were laid here in Berlin in the beginning of 2017. And preparing the ceremony of that laying down of these stones, I got to know Sigrid Grajek, an actor and a singer. And she read two short stories by Eva Sievert about her love to Elise Kallea, short stories that were published in Germany in magazines in 1946 and 1947, but these short stories were totally forgotten. So it was very hard to find the copies of these old magazines. The short stories, they are very, very short, only consisting of one page or one and a half page, and they describe the situation of two women in Germany in 1938, 1939, trying to escape from this country. And these women, they have tried everything. They have tried to get visa to different countries of the world. All the departments, all the authorities they have been in touch with had said no. And one day they decided to go to a fortune teller in order to find a solution. They went to this old woman, and it was a woman who talked little, it is written in the short story published in 1946. The woman, the fortune teller, she had very tiny eyes. And she looked at first at Eva, and said something like, "Well, you are the first to vanish from here. You are going to disappear first." And then she moved, and then she had a hard look on Alice, and then she said, "Well, and then you are the second one, and you are going to vanish from here, far, far away, and you will never, never, ever see each other again." So the two women, they were a bit scared about that, but they went home and then they decided, well, this was nonsense, this was rubbish, this couldn't happen. But the oracle came true a couple of years later, because Eva Sievert, she had been friends with people all around in Germany, and she had written political letters, or letters with political jokes and comments. And some of these letters were found at the houses of her friends. And so she was taken by the Gestapo here in Berlin, and she was put into the women's prison house not far away from the Alexanderplatz. And in that time, when Eva Sievert was in the prison house, her friend, Alice, who was Jewish, she was without shelter because she had spent a lot of her nights in the flat of Eva Sievert before 1933. But then at that point of time, she was without any help. Eva was in the prison house, and Alice, she decided to pretend to be a tourist together with her sister. They traveled to a place not far from Berlin at the seaside, and there they rented a room, and they said, "Well, we are just tourists. We would like to spend the day here. We have lost our papers, so we would like to spend some weeks here. We have lost our papers." But the Gestapo found them, and Alice and her sister were murdered in Auschwitz. They were deported, and when Eva came back from the prison house, everything was changed, and she was alone. I would like to stop the presentation here, because what is most important with our website is maybe that we hadn't that many pictures from before. It was not possible to show a detailed life or biography of Eva or of Alice. There's no picture of her at all. But Sigrid, she made contact with Martina and asked Martina whether she could draw some paintings and give us some illustrations that would show how Eva might have looked like and how Elisa might have looked like, what they did. And then Christina, she came with us, and she was responsible for the technical support and the implementation and for the realization of the whole project. And what is fantastic, even I haven't mentioned that before, here you have some kind of a collage of pictures, texts, photographs, documents, explanations, artificial or artists' imaginations of what happened, what could have happened. And we have audio files of six texts written by Eva Sievert in the 1940s and early 1950s, short stories that deal with her love, her emotions for Elisa. And you can listen to these files on the internet, and maybe we can just
give
an example.
Das Orakel. Damals wurde uns klar, dass Bleiben Lebensgefahr bedeutete. Bis zum 9. November 1938 war der Wunsch nach Auswanderung der Wunsch nach Freiheit gewesen. Jetzt wurde er zur Notwendigkeit. Es galt, sich zu retten. Wir haben kein Konsulat ausgelassen. Es gab keinen Staat der fünf Erdteile, dem wir unser Anliegen nicht vortrugen. Kein Antragsformular für Einreisevisa, das wir nicht gemeinsam ausfüllten. Im August 1939 kam dann endlich aus London die Post, die uns den Rettungsring zuwarf. Ein Mensch, der uns beide zunächst einmal aufnehmen wollte, war gefunden. Ob unser dankbares Antwortschreiben ihn noch erreichte?
Ja, yeah, only so far, and I would like to add some 3 sentences before we, or I finish. The idea with this website was to make the voice or the texts of Eva Sievert accessible, not only in a written form, but in form of audio files. And we thought that it should be a very big thing if these texts and if these files and if these pictures could be used by teachers in school. So we have, I think, a very beautiful website. You can spend 2 hours on it with looking at every picture and reading all the text. And then you can click on 2 buttons in the first row. There on the first one, zum Hören, take zum Hören, yeah. Here you can see the 6 texts underneath each other with the files, and you can even click on this original text, and then you have the PDFs and you can read the texts. So they are only in German, but for everybody who is able to understand German in a written form and who would like to learn more German or to use the German language and to combine listening and reading, could use it, and even at school, of course, it could be used. Then there is another button, zum Lesen. There you can find a bibliography of all the texts by Eva Sievert that have been found up to today. So from 1956 to the 1970s, we have made a documentation of all the texts we have found. So you can find a lot of material there too. And then there's a last button, and maybe you can go there, and I would like to finish there, because when you scroll down on the last button, you see a picture of the 4 of us who have created this website. And I thank you. Well, maybe
here?
Yeah, no, you can scroll down here? all the way down. Yes, at the bottom of the side there are 4 photographs. Yeah. Here you can see us, and I thank you very much for your patience and for your interest in this presentation. Thank you.
Wow. It's fabulous. I mean, as an academic, you know, it's extraordinary to see the work that's being done and the resources that you're manifesting for future research. It's just really incredible. I had to come to Berlin from Canada to meet someone who lives probably blocks away from me, and I didn't know it until today. I'm happy to introduce the last paper and the 2 members of that team, Constance Crompton is an assistant professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Ottawa, where I also live, and is the Canada Research Chair in Digital Humanities. She co-directs the Lesbian and Gay Liberation in Canada project with Michelle Schwartz, and Michelle is a research fellow at the Centre for Digital Humanities at Ryerson University in Toronto. She's co-director of Lesbian and Gay Liberation in Canada, together with Constance. So welcome. Am I pressing too vigorously?
So thank you all for coming. Today Connie and I will be talking about our website that we've been working on for how many years now?
Six, seven?
Seven. Never, it will never end. We'll just work on it forever. LGLC.ca. And it's a gay and lesbian history website for Canada. And so just to give you a bit of a background on it, we were very inspired by Don McLeod, who's here as well. He's a librarian at the University of Toronto and a longtime volunteer at the Archives in Toronto, which is the Lesbian and Gay Archives in Toronto, and we had this goal to increase the amount of publicly available information on Canadian LGBT history, so really bring stuff online and make it easily searchable and easily accessible to both an academic and to students, anyone interested in the history in Canada. And also to find a way to allow users to explore and discover how individual events, people, and organizations became a movement, so really kind of creating an interactive experience for people to move their way through Canadian history.
It's really lovely to be here. We were in the, Lesbian Lives and Histories track yesterday, and I think, we share in common with much better, yes. That we share in common with a lot of the folks who are here, drive for sort of intergenerational communication, and to, as Lourdes Torres had said yesterday, trying to find ways to overcome the frustration of the folks who are having to relearn to organize in every generation, or just sort of fight the same fights over and over again. So we hope that this sort of history project will also serve, as many history projects do, to make people feel connected across generations and to not have to start over from scratch all the time. Right. This is just a little sort of overview of how we've built out the project. At the very heart of the project are two chronologies by Don McLeod that span 1964 with the founding of the first homophile associations at the University of Toronto in Canada, all the way up to the start of the AIDS crisis in 1981. And Don sort of generously allowed us to sort of work with his text. The chronologies exist in book form, and we thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if you could, mix and match these things, or group them so you could just see things by city, or follow the growth of an organization and bring all of those events together. And so Don generously said, you're welcome to text. Good luck with that. You can see his chronology offers a location and a date, as well as a small summary of an event and the sources that he used to create that event record. And the events cover things like poetry readings, protests, legislative change, parties in that 17-year time span. We marked up the text using an XML language called TEI, which let us do all sorts of queries in the text. I know Don had said he wasn't even quite sure how many people are in the text, and we have people with different names at different times and performer names and that sort of thing. And we've used our markup to sort of be able to aggregate and sort. We have roughly 3,000 people in the project. Some people writing pseudonymously and then later saying that this was the name they were writing under, and it lets us kind of aggregate some of those things. We use the XML to drive a series of visualizations and to do some of the more numerical analysis, like the type I had just been mentioning, and then also transformed it out into a graph database to underpin our public history website. Here's the graph database, but with a beautiful new skin on it. We'll demo the site in a little bit, but what we wanted to do was to provide a way for people, as Michelle had said, to move through the text in their own way and to be able to trace whichever sort of facet of the content that they might be interested in, whether that was following a particular person or figuring out what was happening in a particular year or what changes happened in a particular city or province over time. So some of our additions to the project have been that digitization angle, but we're also working on uncovering and adding supplementary material. We have a wonderful team of research assistants who are doing archival research and oral testimony research. One of the things that we're interested in is getting at some of the events that aren't easily archivable. We found that there's lots of material on the opening and closing of clubs or things happening in urban centers. And we wanted to capture some information about sort of queer life in the 70s in rural areas in Canada. We have one wonderful research assistant, Nadine Boulay, who is interviewing older women who are now living on former women's lands and sort of separatist spaces in British Columbia, and capturing records of consciousness-raising potlucks and sort of other events that whose material don't readily sort of end up in the archives. We're also working on expanding the Francophone content in the LGLC. We have a wonderful research assistant, Pascal Dangois. They're all wonderful. They're actually all wonderful. So I would say that of all of them, who has been reading through some Francophone journals. Oh, and I was delighted at one of the talks yesterday to see something about the German branch of Wages Due Lesbians. We also had a Canadian branch of Wages Due Lesbians, and so many of the struggles that they're facing that cross lines of orientation and discrimination, as well as economic oppression, are totally fights that people are having, or struggles that people are having today.
So another area that we're building out based on Don's original text is a prosopography. So a prosopography is it's a collective biography. So we've created this massive Excel spreadsheet that at this point is at the limit of what Excel is capable of, which I always, IT people are very shocked by this. they tell me this should be able to run much more than this, but you've basically killed this program because the spreadsheet is so big, as Connie said, with 3,000 people in it. And it has multiple ways of storing information about people. So it has a basic sort of biographical entries of birth dates and death dates and where people lived. You can also capture the relationships that people had with other people, the relationships that people had with organizations, with occupations that they held, with periodicals that they wrote for, including when people just wrote angry letters into newspapers. We've captured that as well. And so you have this kind of massive piece of biographical information, and you can both do computational things with it, like Tani was talking about, say, I want to know how many people in this data set worked in a certain job or belonged to a certain organization, but you can also access very specific biographical information about individuals. So we're having some of those research assistants that Connie mentioned create little biographies for each person so that when you use the website, you can get a little introductory biography of some of the major players in the movement and, get a sense of what kind of research you might want to do if you're not familiar with the people that were involved in the movement. And we're also going to build out a whole sort of sister site to lglc.ca, which will allow you to just do searches on the specific people. So you can look up individual people, or you can click on, say, lawyer and find all the lawyers that were mentioned in the text, or you can click on, for instance, we have a large number of people who were persecuted by the law, by the criminal justice system, and you can search by the charges that they received, so keeping a common body house or gross indecency, a lot of the sort of a legal framework that was used to persecute the gay and lesbian community in Canada can sort of be captured that way. So it's being built on WordPress with this framework called Pods, and if you're interested in that sort of framework for building a biographical website, personography.1890s.ca is the model that we're building off of. It's a Victorian biographical database, and you can go to that website and see how theirs works if you're interested in that for your own project. So for our next steps, we're thinking about how we can use linked open data to really kind of infiltrate the web, bring LGBT Canadian history into the entire internet. So we're looking at ways that we can align our events, organizations, periodicals, all this kind of information with existing ontologies and vocabularies, so Wikidata, DBpedia, VIAF, all those kinds of sources. So for instance, on the right, we've kind of created a basic ontology for the way that people have relationships in our project. So if you're a person in a relationship with another person, that can be classified as either, say, a professional or a personal relationship, and within that it breaks down into social, familiar, romantic, and criminal relationships, and then, there's further categories from there. So some of those already exist in existing ontologies, like the relationship between a child and a parent or between two siblings, but we have some sort of unique categories, for instance, people who were cruising in parks or public spaces were captured by the database, and you can kind of call that, we've called it a romantic relationship. It's sexual in nature, but I don't know that it exists in any ontologies or vocabularies already. So that's something that we can sort of contribute to the linked open data web.
One of the other things we're hoping to do, I don't know if you've sort of seen the spreadsheets and databases and XML, oh my, that our move to linked data will help us sort of aggregate all of our material, but also, as Michelle was saying, make it more broadly available for integration in other digital history projects. For example, we have records of activist events that Margaret Atwood, who's probably outside of Canada most famous for writing The Handmaid's Tale, that she was involved in, and we want to make it easier for other projects to computationally sort of like slurp in that information so that her activism becomes part of the sort of more public record about her work. There are always those things where you're like, oh, we need to take this to a conference so that we can get feedback and help if folks have experience with some of these things, or you think like, oh, we wrote the Cruising Ontology, have we got that for you? We would really love to talk with folks after the Q&A. And now we will do the thing that they say you should never do at conferences, which is to say, rely on the web to do a live demo of a thing. But we will. It's lovely. I know. I wish Michelle, like, Letterman was like, this is so fantastic. I wish we had more pictures.
Yes, because we have the same problem with the copyright, the issues of copyright. We can't use so many.
No. Mm-hmm. So here's the site for the project itself. We have sort of, you know, home and about, where we have all the wonderful RAs. If you want to know who they were, this is a project that we started just sort of the, like, two of us in a basement and would just have done until we were, like, very old ladies all on our own. But it's really moved along very quickly thanks to the help of lots of wonderful folks. Editorial principles, essays and resources. We're hoping to build out not just sort of essays that show what you can do with this material, but also teaching resources and guides, too. That map onto the Canadian curriculum so that it can be used in classrooms. The real heart of the website itself is this. Mm-hmm. Tell me.
There you go.
Ah, it's the database. We thought when coming here, like.
We'll just do it.
Thank you. you know, do we have anything from Berlin? We mostly have Canadian places in here. It turns out we do have one event in Berlin. The Canadian female impersonator. Here we are. Craig Russell won an award while he was here. What did you press there? You pressed the top only. Oh, well, there you are. I will get you to click about. So that yes, you can sort of search through the database, but our hope is actually that folks will actually sort of navigate through these sort of side panes. The graph representation gives you a sense of like what things are connected to, what sources were used to create this material. And so that's been very sort of useful as a sort of research aid for folks who want to sort of learn more. You can see as clicking through, we went from Berlin to like Craig Russell and everything that he's involved in. If we click on any one of the events, we can then also, you know, read the text of that event and scroll down and see like what sources were used, what other people are involved here, what other events are related, what else was happening at Club Manatee. You can kind of have a look there. And to look at the periodicals that were drawn on there. So like also if folks are interested in like who the archival witnesses are to gay liberation history in Canada, you can have a look through those as well. What comes from the Toronto Sun, for example, or you can click through and follow the lives of organizations.
Where was this supposed to
go? No, that's the works.
Oh, yeah.
There we are. So that is our project, especially in the next step fronts. If folks have advice, we would be glad of it. And we have lots of thanks to go around. We've been well supported by excellent research assistants, the Social Science and Humanities Council of Canada, as well as Compute Canada. So, thank you.
So I'll ask everyone, I think we're one chair short, but we should fit almost all of you. Maybe we could take another chair and put it on stage, but if everybody could come up here, and what I'm going to do, we have a nice amount of time to ask some questions, these interesting presentations. I might even take the chair's prerogative while they're getting set up to ask maybe the first one, which is a very obvious one, Constance Connie. And Michelle, at the very end, and Canadians, we speak very quickly, I've come to notice. That's why I always try and speak super slowly, mindful of how fast I speak. But at the very end of their presentation, they snuck in that their project was funded by the Social Science Humanities Research Council. And I think my sense, if we were to ask all of the folks up here a little bit about the funding situation for their projects, we'd recognize that even in a place like Canada, that as of today seems quite progressive, as of October might be an entirely different place, and projects as wonderful like this may not have the same support after our federal election than it does today. So we're so bound to funding, and I wondered if maybe the panel could speak to their funding sources and their struggles to get their material recognized, or maybe the story is less bleak and it's one of tremendous support. So I'd love it if maybe you might actually speak to that before we open it up to everyone else. And I don't know how you want to fight for the mics.
Well, maybe I can do the starting point. So I have to admit that the website was done, it was realized in a period of time of about 3-4 months or something like that. But all the research that is put into the website has been done voluntarily for about 4 years, 5 years, something like that. Not all the time, but there hadn't been any financiation of the work that I had put into finding sources about Eva Sievert. So we were very happy when in 2018, in the end, or in the summer of 2018, there was a program here in Berlin that supported projects under the name of Lesbian Visibility. So we thought that this project should be in that program, and we sought for the money, we got some money, so we could realize it, but I have to say that there's much more work in this project than ever is paid for what can be seen on the screen now.
Okay. Well, Ilya gets subsidized by the government. We are very well supported by our government in Holland. And all the digitization and preservation and describing the material is paid for. And then the project I'm doing, I do partly at my job, but not too much because it's a hell of a job. So I do a lot at home because it's a bit addictive as well. And Peter, who is my co-creator, he does everything for free, and he has done a lot. So, well, that's an answer, maybe?
I will say that our project is lucky because it straddles sort of multiple fields that we can kind of pull on for support. So it is an LGBT history project, but we're also sort of aligned with the field of digital humanities. So like the project was very much supported by the Center for Digital Humanities at Ryerson University. Like we had research space there for students to work, as well as the Ryerson Library is very interested in building infrastructure for digital projects. So they sort of see us as kind of like a test ground, like the guinea pigs for testing out WordPress with Pods framework or testing out their institutional repository system or DigitalOcean for hosting the site, right? So we're kind of convenient for them in a way that we can have this research project that they can then play with and play with our data and find ways to support it. So I think that that's been very good for us in terms of finding different pockets of support. But we always are very much modeling, you know, Connie was saying we would have done this in a basement by ourselves, and like Don, who wrote the original chronology, sort of did it on his own, right? Like it was very much a passion project, and so I always feel like if we just lost all the money, we would just go back to our basement and just do it on our own at a much slower pace. Yeah.
No, not at all. It wouldn't be that as beautiful as it is, but we would still do it. Yeah.
Great. And then there are microphones on either side, and as you can tell, it's easier to hear if you use the microphone. So if you do have questions, I'd ask you to, yeah, please.
Does it work? Yeah. Okay. I'm Wilfred from Amsterdam. Ilya, I have a question specifically for Raymond and the other people working on the website of Eva Sievert. One of the aims of the website is educational, so you try this, get this into the curriculum of secondary schools, if I understand it well. Is it already being used at schools, and what do you do about promoting it? Could you elaborate on that?
As far as I know, it hasn't been used at school at all, not yet, but the website was, it went online half a year ago, and we have to say that after having realized that project, we were exhausted, because we really need to finish the project in the end of December. So there was a timeline that we had to keep, and well, after that, we have written some letters and emails to teachers and groups of lesbian and gay teachers in the German-speaking area. There have been some responses that people said, well, this is very fantastic, this is nice, but they haven't told us about whether they have used it or not. Yeah. And I haven't had the time to ask them for further information. But I have to say that the first reactions to the website, they were fantastic. They were overwhelming. In the beginning of January, we had some emails from people that we hadn't known from before. An historian from Luxembourg who wrote a book about music and women and radio. And there was someone here in Berlin working with an institution about the forced labor of the Jews before they were deported to concentration camps. And there have been several notions, even from the United States, that there was someone sitting in, I don't know, San Francisco or in Detroit, and she was so obsessed with our website that she said she wanted to translate all the texts of Eva Sievert into the English language. So there have been some reaction we never had dreamt of. But to be honest, teachers or the reactions from teachers could have been, more, could have been. But I consider this as a project in time, and we have created it now, and it stands, it is in the internet, and I hope that we have the opportunity to make more and to become more active in order to stimulate people to use this at school. But so far, I think it hasn't happened. I'm sorry.
Okay, but there's something for a follow-up. Yeah, thank you.
Other questions? Yeah, Ben, will you? Who's going?
So this is a question for Connie and Constance. I'm a little unclear on how public the figures are, the people are in your database, and I'm a little unclear on just how far beyond Don's book it extends. But has the issue of privacy crossed your minds with what you're doing? Because somebody who did something 20 years ago, not expecting in 20 years in the future that suddenly everybody in the world can see everything online, is that something that you're actively considering with what it is that you're doing?
Certainly, yes. We did consider it in the way that the database is constructed. We have, on the one hand, we're lucky in that most of the material comes from an archives that is built around an activist newspaper, and so there are a lot of folks in there who are in the audience and here at this conference who are sort of active to this day, and so there are a lot of people who are still very sort of like public figures in gay liberation in Canada, but the database is designed so that any particular node or person in it can be made a blank node, and that the nodes around them can be blanked as well, which helps with like. It's harder to de-anonymize something, and so we do have a report a problem and kind of like a takedown request and how to do that section on the website. That said, we haven't had any requests, and this is actually something where if people have experience with this too, we would love some help. It's like I go to conferences and there are codes of conduct, but sometimes you can tell at the conference there's a code of conduct, but nobody has training about like what to do when there is a violation of the code of conduct. We haven't actually come across the challenge of like. What would we take down, and under what circumstances?
So all the biographical information was from Don's original book, which is also online as PDFs, and was coming from these activist sources. And anything else was sort of pulled primarily from the internet, like already available. So it's not really so much personal information as it is people's involvement in the movement. And of course, as Connie was saying, we would take down anything that people weren't comfortable with. I do think that there's also sort of an opposing sort of view of the importance of sort of visibility of things. So for instance, in Toronto recently, someone was arrested as a serial killer who was prowling on gay men. People were disappearing from the village, the gay village, for years, and no one believed the gay community that this was happening. And that there's this idea that this could have been going back for decades and people were just disappearing. And we have a lot of those murders, like unsolved murders in our book, which is sort of, you know, like that kind of information, like the criminal side of things is really terrible and tragic. And I think there's also something to be said for the visibility of that information, even though it is very sort of sensitive and personal information as well.
If I could just add to that, as somebody who's done research on police and court files, not in Canada, but in Germany, I mean, it is so tricky, right? Because archivists at Library and Archives, the Bundesarchiv, whatever, have to deal with, you know, entrenched archive laws, so that anything about access to personal data is completely mediated, right? And you have to fill out forms that prove that you're going to use it for scientific purposes and all of the rest. And yet a quasi-academic activist archive online, you know, you are and aren't beholden to those same rules. So like when I hear you say, so people can contact us if they want to be taken down, it's a very different, that's a very different perspective, right, than how a state institution has to operate. So you sort of fall in between a little bit in a way that's great for us wanting access, but may not be so great from the other side of the table. So it's tricky, isn't it? Super tricky. Are there other questions? Yeah, perfect.
Hi. This is a question for any and all of you. These are all fantastic, fantastic projects and very inspiring. I work with an institution here in town, and I think a lot of us may be in a similar situation where the question of digitization is one of the biggest ones that we get from visitors, from people who are asking us kind of what we're doing, how we're moving forward, and yet we have 1.5 million objects in the basement, of which between 80 and 95% are unprocessed. And everyone wants to talk about digitization, everyone wants to talk about going digital, and nobody wants to talk about or pay for the work of putting things in gray boxes, which is less sexy but also very important. And I'm wondering if any of you have any thoughts about, and I think you guys spoke about this a little bit, but kind of using, by connecting projects like this to digital humanities, have you been able to kind of convey the importance of this kind of like first and second level processing work to some folks who maybe understand that and for whom that is legible, but who aren't as invested in the project of putting things into gray boxes and taking them out of messy boxes?
No one else is diving in. I do have thoughts. I have really been like sort of like confronted by the value of the like intensive archival work in working with students who might not have experience in the archives yet, and some of whom, you know, I may even feel like, oh, everything there is to know must already be online. And so like one of the things that has been a real pleasure with the project is that we have some students who are doing, you know, like not computationally intensive work, but who are learning to use archives for the very first time and to value the labor of archivists and like learning how like accession and deaccession works and like how to find these things. So that has been like a happy sort of like a spin-off of the project is training students to appreciate that. Now that's like in 6 years or 7 years, six students. So I don't know that we're like our reach, you know, but the message is maybe isn't that great. But actually one of the things too is that like because everything is so meticulously such meticulous citations on it, I hope that it does like prompt people to sort of go to the archives and to say like, I'd like to see this, and also what else is there, and oh, why isn't there more processed, and what would that take, and you know, yeah.
I didn't quite get the question nor the answer. Could you repeat the question in an easy way for me? It goes very fast, the English.
Sure. Sorry, it's just about basically, the relationship between the kinds of digital projects that all of you have presented, which I find all really fascinating and compelling, and the work of processing the archival material that often has to happen before these things can go public, and thinking about maybe strategies for using the kind of sexy public-facing digital stuff to communicate the importance, whether it's to funders or to stakeholders, of doing the processing work itself. Have you found that at all?
Well, I think it's always a problem of how to get money for the work we have to do. And because it's so much work, like to have a real sexy website is like you sit hours and hours and hours. And like Raimund, what he did was looking forever in some archives and trying to find somehow something about Eva. And this is also work that has never been funded. And I, of course, we all have to think about it. How can we get money for the work we do? I don't know.
Well, maybe I didn't...
Can be done without money, maybe?
So maybe I didn't catch your question, but I think, well, I work as a researcher and as an archivist in the Magnus Hirschfeld Society, so I'm very keen or interested in finding material, and this is a fantastic work to be alone and to find something and to come over something, but then at the end you have to show what you have found. And I've written a lot of articles in scientific magazines, and I think it's a bit boring because I think when I publish an article, I always expect that people should say, wow, this is wonderful, this is great. There's no reaction at all. Yeah? So sometimes I wonder whether there are people who read these kinds of articles. Yeah. So in this case, with the Eva Sievert website, it was so much fun to make something different, to have moving pictures, to have an access via art and via imagination. And we had the files, we had the pictures, we had the knowledge of Christina to make something in a technical way that I never would have been able to realize. So I'm very grateful for this project team. It opened new ways for my kind of work too. And I would like to realize more projects in this style. Maybe in a couple of years of time it will be boring to see another Eva Sievert site or another site with, I don't know, something about another woman, about another man and so on. But I feel that we have come to another stage of presenting something using the internet. I did this for the first time. I have written on Wikipedia, but of course that is boring too, to just read a text. And here you could make something accessible in a way that gives you emotions, that is in some way erotic, that is in some way personal. And I think this was a great challenge, and I'm very proud of this site. Yeah, but of course, for another site, you have to do some research for about 4 or 5 years again, and then it is possible to show just some tiny part of it.
Now we have a question over here.
Hi, I'm Brett Lahid from the University of Winnipeg. Shout out to all the Canadians on stage.
Goodness, like, how many Canadians in 1 year? This is insane.
My question is about long-term preservation. These are all web-based projects utilizing platforms that might not be around for a whole lot longer. So I'm just wondering whether you all have plans in place for the long-term preservation of your projects, so you know all the hard work you put into them doesn't disappear over time.
That's a very good question. For my project, I use HistoryPin. That is free. It's American. There are some lesbians in the team, so I have had no problems with explicit content so far, and I'm very surprised about that. But I've also heard that they have financial problems, so when they get out of business, I have nothing. And it's like with Flickr is somehow going away, and there are more platforms come up and then they go down again. So it's very important, in fact, to do things better. We do with the original material we have preserved very well, the pictures, but not the information. So you would have to build your own database and make it more durable? Is durable a good word?
Sustainable.
Yes, and then you come with the money problem, of course. That's my concern. It's very concerning. If somebody else gets the lead there, they will say, oh, God, this is full of dicks and tits and faggots. You can't do. I cannot write the word faggot because they say this is bad language. You shouldn't use that. Mm. But I can show them. But I think for how long? Somebody will say, okay, we have. I showed you only the mustaches, but there's much more to see. So, yes, it's a good question.
So definitely we too have thought about the question of, like, you know, preservation and long-term sustainability with, like, digital projects, especially that have, like, interactive front ends. Like, those are often not sustainable or not something that, like, a library or an archive would be willing to take over. The reason that, like, I was so excited to show, like, all the blue and orange text, all of our XML, is that that's a static format, and the University of Alberta Libraries has agreed to take and preserve that, and there are more and more repositories that will take static files like that. But I don't think, like, once we die of old age, like, we'll just do this project forever. But, like, I don't know that there will be, like, libraries who are interested in taking over something like the whole front end and the database itself, which does need to be updated and migrated over time. So I would say, like, our best strategy right now is, like, working with, like, very static files to make beautiful dynamic things on top, which might not last forever, but to always have that static layer underneath.
Well, maybe from, I don't know, from our point of view, I had the idea, what would be the alternative to this website? So at first, when I heard Sigrid's voice at the laying of the stumbling stones, I thought, well, we should do something with this, because this was so impressive. It was so moving to hear a text that I had read a thousand of times or sometimes, but when I heard it read by a human being, it touched me. It really touched me. And I wanted a lot of people to come into the same situation as I was in. And I decided at first we should produce a CD. And then everybody said, well, that's old-fashioned. Don't do that, because nobody buys CDs. Yeah. So we have created this website now, and I think we have, I don't remember the details, but I think that we have financed the first 5 years of it. So we have to pay the rent for the place and the internet, and everything is fine. I don't know what is going to happen in a 5 years' time, but I feel that in some way we have opened a window to the world of Eva Siebert. And now it is possible to look into that room and find out whether this is important to us or not, whether there are any connections to other people. I don't know, we present a human being in a certain historical, political situation, and we present what she was able to do with the experiences she collected under the war and after the war. So I hope that the website Eva Siebert will be read, seen, and talked about, and that there will be some people who write about it and use this material and make connections to other sites or to other books or to other artists or to other writers. And of course, I know we haven't found the original voice of Eva Siebert yet. So maybe somewhere outside in an archive in Luxembourg or in Paris or in Amsterdam or I don't know where her original voice might be. And Eva Siebert, she wrote even books about lesbianism in 1950. These books were never published, so she had manuscripts of about 400, 500 pages, and they have never been found, they have never been published, they have never been used. And now this window is open, and maybe sometime someone finds one of these manuscripts lying in an archive somewhere. And it is maybe worthwhile to have a sort of look at these manuscripts or to have, maybe this is a trigger in order to find further sources. This is the hope I have with the site. But what happens in a 5 years' time, I don't know.
an international crowdfunding for archiving and for archives of the worldwide history of LGBTIQ. I think this should be the one thought that we really can be sure that all the work will last, because this would be a pity if all the work go down the street. I mean, this is it's wertvoll. Valuable. It's very valuable, the work we did all together, and so we should find a way. And an international crowdfunding, something like this, why not?
I promise to you that this isn't a conspiracy. I'm also from Canada. my name is Jonathan Dory. I'm from the Quebec Gay Archives in Montreal. One of the issues that we have at our institution with a fairly big chunk of our collection is arriving. It doesn't really happen quite as bad nowadays, but when we would arrive in the morning, we would find garbage bags in front of the door, and this is how we've acquired some of our collections. So we've talked about copyright, we've talked about privacy, which are two very important issues, but have any of you come across problems where you have material that you don't doubt its authenticity, but you have no information about who donated it, who these people were, where it came from? Like, is this something that you've experienced? I'm also interested in how do you preserve packets of lubes? This is a very important question because I have the exact same problem at the AGQ. So if you want to talk about ephemera of condoms and packets of lubes, please go ahead.
Hi. So basically that's two questions, isn't it? I was just worried. I thought, oh God, I said faggot. And now they think that's the way we talk. I use that word, but in the ephemera, these words are used, and the language used over the years of self-identification has changed so much, and it's nice to see how bad names can be used as a geuzennaam, a name of honor, and that's a very good tactic, of course, to make it less nasty. But of course, the big database systems know the bad words, and they don't know that they can be used as symbols of pride. Sorry. About the privacy. Well, we are Ilya. We are 40 years working on the privacy issues, and I'm not really the one who can talk a lot about it. It would be our archivist. And we have a large collection of things that cannot be seen. They are forbidden to be seen unless you need them for research. And like personal archives, I know if people say, okay, they can be seen 10 years after my death, or they can't be seen at all, which is a bit, well, why would you keep them then? But there are all sorts of arrangements possible. But we are careful, which is logical. In a way. Is that enough? Okay, somebody? Yeah.
So, we had only one person to tell a story about her. And since we are so used to say, well, she's a lesbian, she's a dyke, whatever, in the middle of the project, I said, are you sure she was a lesbian? Do you really know this? So Raimund said, yes, look in this text and in this text, the way she describes the love affair. And so we started to think about what was the wording at her time. Did they really talk about, I'm a lesbian? So this was also interesting to have reflections about wordings and to do a real good job on the person. Was she really a lesbian? She never wrote anywhere, I am a lesbian. But we would say, yes, she was. So, you never know.
I know that people from the archives in Toronto and also the Schwules museum would love to talk about all the problems of unprocessed collections. But what I was made to think of was the idea of accuracy, right, and having accurate information up. For the prosopography, the collective biography, we sort of followed this methodology called the factoid model, which is the idea that multiple sources can assert something, and they can conflict with each other, and there's no really truth, right, about a person. There could be the Toronto Sun called someone, you know, a gay man, but that person called themselves like a faggot in the body politic, right, because that was their personal identification. So there's this kind of assertions about people. We have a colleague, Felicity Taylor at the University of Ottawa, who has a similar sort of model of people with a network graph. And what she's been doing is going to the people who still survive, because she's working on the 1980s in Canada, and she shows them the graph of their lives, and she asks them, like, is this true? Is this accurate? And then she has people fighting with her, telling her it's not true, that, oh, I was never his boyfriend. Like, that's ridiculous. Oh, he wishes. And then kind of aggregates that information into her network, and it grows all the assertions that can be made. I think she's very brave to do that with the living people, to say, like, did I get you right, and have them yell at her about it, because I know Connie came from Victorian studies where everyone's dead, so no one can ever come to Connie and tell her she got it wrong, because they're no longer amongst us. But that is one model where you can, when you have living subjects, actually just ask them.
I just wanted to give like a shout out to Aaron DeVore from the Transgender Archive at the University of Victoria, who is here, in that like I think he's got a novel approach to like trying to make sure material ends up with him, but that doesn't like, or his archive, but that doesn't just show up in a black plastic bag. That he is here with stickers. He says, like, everyone who comes to my conference gets a whole sheet of these, like, take some of these now that just say on them, like, this is not trash, please send it to the Transgender Archives, here's the address and here's how to do it. And I think, like, passing those out so that people can put them on their, you know, belongings when they die to say, like, what is valuable in here and that might help keep some of the provenance there, was just a really clever strategy. That doesn't help with how to process lube. Yeah.
Yeah, and I know the Lesbian Herstory Archive in Brooklyn, New York, has a section on their website about how to start processing collections yourself as an individual. Just get out some folders and a pencil and start writing down what these things are before you give it to us, which is, yeah, interesting.
So we've run out of time. I just wanted to put a couple of things in everyone's mind, because what I've been hearing with the panel. One, a tremendous amount of work that goes into these projects, hugely important, often volunteer labor, and the struggle, it seems to me, is how to get that material off of the web and then into the hands of other users. It would be wonderful if, whether now or later, there could be some brainstorming and sharing of ideas about how to influence curricula, how to use social media to engender interest, how to connect with scholars and other organizations, because, you know, it's one thing to put it up there, and there's so much work that goes into it, and it's another thing to make sure that it gets the attention that it deserves. And then the final thing I will say is, and you have no time to answer, I was just curious if you've actually looked at your analytics, you've gone behind the scenes to see who is landing on these pages, and if that might be something worth sharing. We can't do it here, so maybe you can catch me before we leave. Let's give them a big round of applause.